Hello and welcome to this podcast from Blackwell Online. My name is George Miller, and my guest today is Tim Harford, the Financial Times undercover economist and presenter of Radio 4's More or Less. A couple of years ago, Tim appeared in the Blackwell Online podcast when he told me about his previous book, The Logic of Life. I met up with him again recently in a cafe in North London to hear about his new book, Adapt, which takes inspiration from the mechanisms of evolution and argues that only by failing and, crucially, learning from our failures, do we truly learn to succeed. Selection and adaptation. We have to try out new ideas, test them on a scale where failure is survivable, and learn from our mistakes. Tim sees applications for this approach in domains as diverse as business, coping with climate change, and the war in Iraq, and he thinks we don't apply it nearly enough. I began by remarking that although children are often taught the mantra of try, try, and try again, our culture doesn't embrace the potential benefits of failure. And that kind of dogged persistence isn't really what he's advocating in any case.
I should probably first say that, I mean, children are told if at first you don't succeed, try again. But I think it's become a cliche because actually learning from your mistakes in general is quite difficult. And children are also taught that there are right answers, that if only you're smart enough, you'll find the right answers, and there's a person in the corner who knows what the right answers are. And none of this, I think, is particularly helpful when it comes to actually navigating a very complex world. So I have three principles for failing productively. If you want to try and boil down the book into bullet points. So number one is you need to be trying lots of different things. Number two is you need to be prepared for failure. In other words, if something goes wrong, that shouldn't be bringing down all your hopes and dreams. You've got to be robust to failures because they will happen. But the third really gets to the nub of your question. So the third is you've got to know the difference between success and failure. You've got to know what's working and what's not after you've tried it out. That sounds really simple, right? Know whether you've failed or not. It turns out it's tremendously complicated. We seem to be really hardwired to stick doggedly with failures long after we should have realized their failures. It's partly because the world is complicated, it's not always easy to tell. It's partly because organizations are often designed to cushion people from bad news. You're surrounded by yes men who won't tell you the things that aren't going right. But most of all, I think it's just psychologically. We get into a particular mental rut, we assume that we know what we're doing, we assume that we've got things right, and frequently we haven't.
Yeah, you talk in the book about chasing our losses, which is, I suppose, like throwing good money after bad, and sort of various forms of denial that we can get into about the nature of our losses.
Yeah, I mean, I interviewed lots of people for the book. I interviewed serving soldiers in Iraq and would-be astronauts and environmentalists and all kinds of people. But some of the people I interviewed were poker players, and they told me all about this loss-chasing behavior. It's very common in poker to make a mistake or perhaps just have bad luck and therefore take a loss. You had a lot of money on the table and somebody else wins it. The question is, how do you then respond to that loss? And professional poker players know that that is the moment of greatest weakness. It's not the first loss. It's the stupid things you then do to try to make up the loss. And they call it going on tilt. So you start getting very aggressive. You start taking unnecessary risks in an attempt to get back what you perceive as being your money. And if that was just poker players, fine. But actually, stock market investors exhibit the same behavior. There's a wonderful study I describe in the book of players on the Noel Edmonds game show Deal or No Deal, where they also chase losses. We do this in our own lives. I mean, any boss who refuses to wrap up a failed project, or politician who refuses to make the U-turn because it's embarrassing, and of course in our own lives, you know, as individuals, we get very invested in the decisions that we've made and very reluctant to reverse them because that's an acknowledgement of failure. If you keep gambling, if you keep pushing, you know, good money after bad, you know, maybe at some stage your investment will pay off. And that's what we tell ourselves. And of course, we turn small mistakes into very big ones because of that.
I was also interested in the phenomenon of hedonic editing, which is a kind of sort of reinterpreting reality to suit our own beliefs about ourselves, isn't it?
So this is a phrase coined by the behavioural economist Richard Thaler, who's the author of Nudge and will probably win the Nobel Prize one day. And hedonic editing is the idea of sort of wrapping together losses and gains in ways that make them less painful. So one of the earliest findings in behavioural economics is the existence of something called loss aversion. Loss aversion is basically a serious anxiety about what are actually very small losses. So it's nice to find £5 in the street. It's annoying to lose £5 in the street. It's much more annoying to lose the £5 than it is pleasant to find the £5. So that's the loss aversion. Hedonic editing is where you say, I lost £5 in the street, but also I got given £20 for my birthday, so I'm £15 ahead and that's okay. And now, in that particular case, there's nothing wrong with hedonic editing. But if somebody delivers what I might call a praise sandwich to you at work, says, oh, you've done wonderful, wonderful, wonderful work, it's a great report, whatever, and then says, oh, but actually there is a problem, small problem, they tell you about the small problem, and then they finish by saying, but as I say, you've done great work. They're trying to cushion the blow, but what we might do when faced with that praise sandwich is just to say, well, so on average then, it's fine. We don't pay attention to the criticism at all because we're saying to ourselves, well, broadly things are okay. I was really struck by what I'm told are the practices at Pixar, who make all these wonderful animated films. In Pixar, there's a lot of internal criticism to try to make these films better and better, but the idea is to avoid saying whether something's good or bad. Don't tell us whether it's good or bad. Who cares whether it's good or bad? Just tell us what could make it better. And that's a much more constructive way of giving gentle criticism in a way that the criticism will get heard.
And you point out the dangers of surrounding yourself with yes men, people who simply confirm your views, which can have very serious real world consequences, for example, in the case of Lyndon Johnson.
Yes, yeah, so Lyndon Johnson, of course, took the United States into war in Vietnam. And Johnson, I mean, he clearly had many achievements as well, but for some reason Johnson didn't like people to argue in front of him. He didn't like to be a witness to disagreement. And so he would say to his generals and his advisors, you know, across the board, you decide and then come and tell me and, you know, give me your advice. And that meant that he wasn't so much yes men, but he was shielded from witnessing disagreements and shielded from these uncertainties and basically presented with a settled view. He had Robert McNamara as his defense secretary, and Robert McNamara liked to operate in this way. So McNamara would ruthlessly suppress all the dissent and choose his own policy and then go and present the policy to Lyndon Johnson. And Lyndon Johnson would nod it through, which is fine as long as you've got the right policy. But given that in a very complicated world, you often don't have the right policy, you're often not doing the right thing, error correction is tremendously important. An error correction where the decision maker cannot witness the gears grinding in the decision making process, error correction is extremely difficult.
I suppose, Tim, that the big metaphor of the book is biological evolution. Now, what do you think that can tell us about the way that, for example, companies function in our commercial economic world?
Biological evolution is built on a foundation of variation and selection, which you could say is trial and error. Okay, variation, selection, trial, error. You try lots and lots of things out, and then there's this ruthless process where survival of the fittest, whereby only a few of them survive, and then the next generation is built on the survivors. So this happens in the economy as well. I could tell you lots of things about the American economy, but I think the most important thing is that 10% of American businesses disappear every year, which is this huge failure rate. I like to joke, it's much higher than the failure rate of Americans. So clearly American companies are evolving much faster than Americans. And there's no mystery as to where the variation comes from. You know, new ideas, new businesses, entrepreneurs, middle managers, technologists, scientists, you know, lots of sources of new ideas in the economy. And there's no mystery either as to where the process of selection comes from. It comes from consumers deciding what they will and won't buy and companies going bankrupt all the time. So the economy itself is an evolutionary system. Now, some analysts take this really far and they use full-on biological models to understand economic growth. I don't think that's particularly necessary. It's not something I do in the book. But it is very important to understand how much trial and error is going on in this system. And when we're trying, the market solves lots of problems very well. It doesn't solve all problems. But when we're trying to solve problems that the market can't solve, whether we're talking about counterterrorism, counterinsurgency, climate change, promoting innovation, when we're trying to solve these problems, I think we need to bear in mind why the market does what it does. And it is this process of trial and error.
One of the most interesting ideas I thought in the book was that we mustn't take false comfort from the fact that there's a lot of innovation in the fields of software, where startup costs are very low, and you can have hundreds of thousands of apps for your iPhone. But in fact, we have to really look beyond that and think there are other areas. You know, we don't yet have a vaccine for AIDS. There are lots of other big problems, climate change, where we haven't actually solved them. So in those cases, the process of experimentation comes with a much higher cost, doesn't it?
Absolutely. If someone says to you, I work in a technology company, or I work in high tech, you immediately automatically think of computers. Is hardware or software? That's what you assume they're talking about. So all pervasive has this section of innovation become that we find it hard to think of any other kind of innovation. And you know, we look at the progress in computing, and I mean, I'm a huge fan of computers. My dad worked in computing all his working life. I'm on Twitter. I love this stuff, but it's not everything. Just because we've made huge strides in social media, in hardware, in software and so on, doesn't mean we've solved all the innovative problems. And I think we get really distracted. And yeah, you mentioned the vaccine for AIDS. So we were promised a vaccine for AIDS within 2 years, back in 1984. It's late. I flew to America on book tour. I flew on a Boeing 747. Boeing 747 was designed in 1968. It's still the major long distance carrier and probably will be for at least another 10 years, maybe 20 years. So this, and of course, energy. We still have a huge energy problem. China's still using lots of coal. Where is this sort of cheap, limitless, clean energy we've been promised for decades? So there are serious technological problems to solve. And I think the success of Silicon Valley, which is very real, has distracted us from a lack of progress in those areas.
You write at length about the Iraq War, and I suppose listeners may think, well, I can see how experimentation, trial and error can work within the confines of a company or medical research or whatever. But when it comes to an organization which really by definition is hierarchical and has a chain of command such as the US Army, isn't it dangerous? Isn't it a recipe for chaos, I suppose, to allow experimentation and allow the possibility of failure when you're talking about a real world occupation of a country?
This is something the US Army has been wrestling with. And there's a guy called General H.R. McMaster who was serving under David Petraeus in Afghanistan. I assume now Petraeus has moved. McMaster may also have moved. I need to find out where he is. But his job immediately before that was to rewrite US Army doctrine. And what McMaster argued was, the world's so complicated, it's so fast moving, so many decisions have to be taken by the person on the ground. You need to delegate a tremendous amount. You need to allow individual soldiers the ability to adapt to local circumstances. And this was something that McMaster was pushing hard. I mean, one example, another counterinsurgency expert, John Nagel, said, you know, I, as major with a PhD in counterinsurgency, did not have the authority to write a pamphlet arguing against the local insurgents and putting over our point of view in Iraq. But the 18-year-old kids that I commanded had the authority to shoot to kill. So there's this real mismatch in delegating authority. You know, you're allowed to decide to kill somebody, but you're not allowed to create a pamphlet. So this is the kind of thing McMaster was arguing the US Army needed to change. I think McMaster has real authority. Not only was he, as a colonel, I think, responsible almost more than anybody else for reinventing US strategy in Iraq at a time where all his superior officers were telling him to quit. He was passed over for promotion twice. He was denied reinforcements. I mean, he was under tremendous pressure from the chain of command above him. He really reinvented US strategy, and his innovations were copied very quickly by other majors, by other colonels, which is fascinating about the way that new ideas spread through an organization. But not just that. McMaster was a war hero from the first Gulf War. When he was in this engagement, which was written up by Tom Clancy, and it's like a boy's own story, where he was commanding a small group of tanks, 9 US tanks, in the middle of a sandstorm, and stumbled upon a much, much larger force of Saddam Hussein's Republican Guard. They were outnumbered 10 to 1. And McMaster very, very quickly made a decision that saved the lives of all of his men, and they won this battle. And it was celebrated by the US Army as this tremendous triumph for the US Army. But McMaster immediately saw it as, although it had been a success, it was so, so close to a failure. They so nearly got killed. And it demonstrated the weakness in the US Army's model of everything being done via air support, everything being done by satellites, everything, situational awareness being rendered on a computer screen. And McMaster said, you know, you cannot run a war like this. The decisions ultimately are going to have to be made by the men on the ground. And if you are not willing to delegate to the men on the ground, you're going to lose war after war after war.
Do you think one of the lessons is that information dominance, this concept that was much touted during the Iraq War, is actually a chimera? It's a myth.
It absolutely is. And it's not just a myth in military operations. It's a myth in the economy as well. We know the scene almost from the movies, the idea that somehow you can understand what's going on in the world, in a war, in an economy, by just sitting in this big leather armchair, stroking this white cat and looking at a wall full of computer screens and television screens. You somehow take in all this information. With enough information technology, you can understand how an economy is working, how a society is working, and make decisions. We can never do that. There's just too much going on. There are probably 10 billion distinct products and services on sale in the London economy alone. 10 billion different types of product and service. Many of them have global supply chains we don't fully understand. I mean, just the number of different decisions being made every day in the economy defies tracking. It doesn't matter how good the computers get. We're never going to be able to figure out everything that's going on. And that means there will always be this process of decentralization. And there will always be this process of experimentation, of trial and error. And if we refuse to acknowledge that, we're going to keep on making bad decisions.
I wanted to ask you, Tim, about this notion of expertise, because I wondered if it was more than coincidental that McMaster is a trained historian as well as a military man, and Nagel as a PhD in counterinsurgency. Because you begin the book by saying, basically, reporting some researcher says, basically, if you want to get a muddled view of what's going to happen, ask the experts, because experts don't really have any great predictive power at all. And yet it seemed to me that McMaster and Nagel both had a sort of depth of knowledge which somehow must have contributed to their success on the ground.
Well, they had a huge depth of knowledge, and there's nothing wrong with expertise. I mean, if I need to have heart surgery, I would like to be operated upon by an expert surgeon. If my computer goes wrong, I'd like it to be fixed by an expert programmer. I mean, nothing wrong with expertise. We just need to understand that it's intrinsically limited when you're dealing with these very, very complex social economic problems. There's just too much going on for any one person to understand. So, I mean, I'm not arguing against expertise. I'm arguing against the idea that you can solve these problems right first time, and you never need to sort of check whether your solution worked. One symptom of this, which I report in the book, is the incredibly low forecasting success of experts in sort of social, historical, economic spheres. I mean, it's basically the forecasting record is non-existent. We're just terrible. We can't do it. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about economists or historians or psychologists or sociologists, we can't do it. That's because the problems are too complex. So the expertise has to operate at a different level, to start off with some workable plan, and then to constantly monitor it and figure out whether it's working and what different ideas might be tested out and which of those ideas are working, and then, you know, to constantly adapt and evolve as you go along. I mean, you're absolutely right to take the case of the Iraq War. McMaster, Petraeus, Nagel, they all had PhDs. They were all expert. But so did General John Abizaid. John Abizaid probably knew more about the Middle East than any other US commander. He was in charge of, he was number two at the time of the Shock and Awe operation in Iraq, and he later went to be in charge of all US operations in the Middle East. And Abizaid, brilliant, but he basically got it wrong. He was paying too much attention to the lessons learned in Lebanon and not enough attention to the lessons learned by the British operating in Malaya. And, you know, it turns out you can't just, expertise is not enough. You can't just sort of say, well, I've got this historical example and that will guide me. There was no reason intrinsically to say Abizaid would turn out to be wrong and Petraeus, McMaster and Nagel would turn out to be right. I mean, a priori, we have no idea. You had to put these ideas to the test, see what's working, and then rapidly adapt in the light of what you're learning. So the problem is not expertise. The problem is thinking that expertise means you do not have to monitor, adjust, adapt, and fix errors. That's the problem.
Now, moving to a very different sphere, that of the arts, there's a very interesting chapter late in the book where you talk about the Billy Joel Twilight Art collaboration, Movin' Out, which was panned by the critics when it opened in Chicago. And Twilight Art, the choreographer, rethought it, and it was re-engineered, and it was put on the stage in New York. And to cut a long story short, it was a huge triumph. Now, it struck me reading that, what if Stravinsky had decided to do the same thing after the disastrous premiere of The Rite of Spring? Which may sound like a flippant point, but I suppose what I'm saying is, how do you know when to listen to the critics and which critics to listen to and in order to make the right decisions?
I think it's a very good point, and there are frankly no easy answers. The situation Twyla Tharp was faced with was she was subject to this sort of very widespread criticism. And the question was, well, should you pay attention or not? So the first thing she did was sat down for breakfast with an old friend who'd been with her 40 years and had always challenged her. And the first thing her friend said was, you know they're right. Imagine, you're sitting, you're having breakfast with this old friend, you've got all these newspapers in front of you, all the critics have panned you, and your friend says the critics are right. And you really trust this judgment of your friend who has your best interests at heart. Okay, so that's a reason to take the critics seriously. So then the second thing she did was to ask her son, who's also her manager, to go through the reviews and to highlight if the critics kept picking up on the same issues, there was probably, you know, it wasn't just a personal animus or lack of imagination. They probably were onto something. And it turns out one of the things that they found was there was visual confusion on stage. There was a band in full view, and there was also dancing. So do you look at the band or do you look at the dancing? So one of the things she did was to move the band into a conventional orchestra pit so that there was only one thing to focus on. But there were other issues about the complexity of the plot, and you know, some things just didn't seem to make any sense. Some characters seemed to be random. And they were being highlighted by critic after critic after critic. So that was a point where you could say, yeah, I've mediated the criticism through the judgment of people that I trust, and it still seems to stand up, it still seems to make sense. So at this point, maybe I need to take the criticism seriously. But you know, there is no right or wrong answer to this. There are many people in the book who I regard as heroes, who basically stood up for what they believed was right, despite a lot of criticism, and eventually turned out to be proved correct by events. So I don't think that psychologically there's a straightforward answer. You could say, in your personal life, you should do this or you should do that, you should behave like this or you should behave like that. The world's just too complicated to prescribe these simple bullet points. Instead, what we need to say is, well, what are the systems that tend to produce correct solutions, eventually correct solutions? And they are highly pluralistic systems with lots and lots of different people experimenting with lots and lots of different things. And they're systems that allow the correction of error. And in your personal life, you can try and emulate these systems, but it's always going to be tough.
One of the presiding spirits of the book, it seemed to me, was Peter Palchinsky. Can you say a little bit about why you think, I mean, I presume he is a hero in the context of the book. What do you think was special about him?
He is a hero. He's a tragicomic hero. All you really need to know about Peter Palchinsky was he was the engineer who told Joseph Stalin he was wrong. And you can imagine what happened to him. And Palchinsky was this amazing guy. He seemed to have a compulsion to be honest at all times. So at one point where he's touring through Western Europe learning about engineering, he writes to his wife saying, oh, by the way, you know, I've been sleeping with other women, I hope you don't mind. Another stage, writes a letter to the Prime Minister of the Soviet Union saying, by the way, communism is all very well, but I hope you understand that science and engineering is more important than communism. There's no reason to write this letter. You're just asking for trouble, and his friends managed to persuade him not to send it. And these repeated criticisms of Soviet engineering projects, Stalin's, you know, big, you know, huge dam, White Sea Canal, a huge iron mining and smelting city. At all points, he felt compelled to tell the truth. So in a sense, he was almost ridiculous because he was telling the truth in these absurd situations where it was going to get him killed, and it did get him killed. But Palchinsky, in his criticisms of these Soviet engineering projects, the base of his criticism led me to outline my three principles for failing successfully. So the first thing was, he was always very careful to expose himself to new ideas. He did tour Western Europe and so this idea of, don't just take the first idea that comes along. You need to be exploring lots and lots of different options. The second thing is, you need to be very rigorous about collecting data and evaluating what's working and what isn't working. So this is the idea of, you know, figure out what's a failure and what's a success. And the third point was, always start small. Often he would take these gigantic engineering projects and say, there's actually no reason why we can't start with a little dam or a little engineering, just do this on a smaller scale and see whether the demand emerges, see whether the technology works. And then if it does, we can build more. So his criticisms, although they got him killed, were very much a prototype for the way I think people should be making decisions in a complex world.
Final question, Tim. Have you personally had any particularly instructive, successful failures in your own career?
I could list several. I think the one that really sticks in my mind was immediately after leaving university, my first job was as a management consultant. And I was a terrible management consultant. A friend of mine, who's also a management consultant, said, well, look, all you need to do to succeed in this business is wear a suit and talk crap. And just two things, and you can't do either of them. You know, as I confessed to her, I was allergic to my suit. And I really was. It brought me out in a rash. And so I was having this miserable time at this management consulting firm. And many, many friends were saying to me, you really need to stick it out. You know, you need to do a couple of years. You need to, this is your first job. You don't want to look flaky. And, but a couple of people whose judgment I really trusted said, you hate this. You're having a horrible time. You're never going to make a success of this because you hate it. Why waste 2 years of your life demonstrating that despite the fact you hate it and you're bad at it, you could still do it? Why not just leave immediately and find something else? So I left after about 3 months. And that was very, very good advice, but it wasn't the main advice that I was getting. So I mean, that really, really has stuck in my mind. It's okay to have this failure as long as you fail quickly enough and find something else to do.
Tim Harford. Adapt is out now in hardback. You can find out more about all of Tim's books, plus several million others, by visiting Blackwell Online at blackwell.co.uk. You'll also find a podcast archive there with over 150 author interviews by clicking on the podcast tab on the home page. That's all for this edition of the Blackwell Online podcast, but I hope you'll join me again soon for another programme. Until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.